This is the Aftermarket Radio Network.
Hey everyone, Carm Capriotto, Remarkable Results Radio, here at the Max 2024 44th Annual Training Event in Orlando. Neat place here, Rosen. I don't know about you. This is a huge place.
Yeah, I've gotten lost several times.
Yeah, I know, I hear you. And there's a few shortcuts in here that I have to learn, but we're here for 3 days. Lots of things going on. 35 speakers, 70 hours of mobile AC vehicle thermal management training. We have had a plethora of different interviews that we've done here today. We're taking back so much information. Air conditioning is on almost every vehicle that I know, known to man, and on our homes and everything that we see and touch. And I've had a new appreciation for the technology that it takes and the commitment that so many of the people that are here, not only in the manufacturing side, but all the educators and all the shop owners that are here and all the OE people that are here. I'm with Adam Kimmel.
That's right.
Hey, Adam. He's from Cora. He said to me off record, he says, Carm, I'm a chemical junkie. And I said, well, let's set that up in a very professional way at the beginning of the show. Remember, if you earn your living in the service aftermarket, then Apex is the expo for you. Continue listening and we'll bring you the latest from Apex 2024. Save the date, November 5th through the 7th, 2024. Hey, let's face it, your shop management system is the most critical tool in your shop. And Napatrax will move your shop into the SMS fast lane with on-site training, 6 days a week support, and local representation. Find Napatrax on the web at napatrax.com. I walked by your booth and I saw all these, you know, jugs of stuff. So you make the stuff that makes the car cool.
Well, exactly. And there's a ton of chemistry that goes into that. And so I think the more you understand about the chemistry and how it works, the better you can solve the problems about cooling passengers and then ultimately thermal management in the vehicle.
Okay, let's start with sperm and egg, okay? Fluorine.
Yeah.
Right? At the beginning of life, he's telling me about, yeah, we mine fluorine. And I says, so what's that got to do with refrigerant?
Yeah. So fluorine is central to what we do. We're vertically integrated. So we've got the raw material up through now the end products. And so for many years, under various name incarnations and changes, we've supplied various steps in that supply chain. So the fluoro spar material comes out of the mine. There's acid spar that we supply to different customers. And ultimately, it's made into refrigerants. So a few process steps later, the mine is a heck of a thing to see. I had the chance to go to it when I was in Mexico. It's right in the geographic center of Mexico. And it was about 300 meters underground. I think we went around and around, you know, deep into the mine to see where they were actively mining this fluorine.
So it's in rocks. You're pulling up rocks.
It is. Yeah. It's attached to, I think, some calcium material inside the mine. So that's where it comes from in the earth.
What does it take to get the fluorine out of the rock?
Well, there's to get it off the rock, there's some blasting that goes on, right?
Okay, I get that.
Yeah. And then there's a ton of post-processing, and we'll try to go into every single step. And certainly, yeah, you know, huge plants and steps and processes that go on between that rock collection and the refinement to get the end product that eventually gets made into the refrigerant.
And a lot of other things.
For sure. Yeah, there's different reactions and things that go into it depending on what the end product is that you want.
You said hydrogen fluoride yesterday as we were kind of doing our icebreaker meeting to figure out what the heck and, you know, what can we talk about? And oh my God, wait till you hear the rest of this episode. But hydrogen fluoride, is that anything to do with our teeth?
Well, yeah. I mean, the fluoride is in toothpaste. I'm not sure if it's I don't think it's the same exact composition.
It doesn't come from fluorine.
Well, it does, but it's a different form. So the hydrogen fluoride is an acid. It's considered a weak acid, but it's very powerful. And so that material is used to make, you know, many things. So it's one of the byproducts of the mine extraction process. And then it gets sent around to make refrigerant.
So interesting. And I find this fascinating because I am a perpetual student. I love to learn this stuff and how much of it's going to stick in my mind so that I could maybe repeat it someday. I was talking to Adam and he was talking about, but thermal management fluids is what you guys are about, right?
Yeah, that's really the center of what refrigeration has become in the mobile industry. And, you know, it was how to keep passengers cool for many years. But then with all the inventions and heat pumps and other things coming, it is less about refrigeration and more about thermal management, the efficient movement of heat around the cabin. There's a battery in there that'll need cooled eventually. And there's just, you know, different sources of heat in the vehicle that get used and transmitted and transferred in different forms to make the processes as efficient as we can get them.
Are you working with manufacturers and with SAE? I mean, how connected are you to learn what needs to be done, what challenges that we have? And then you go back to the brainiacs, the chemists, and say, hey, let's try this?
That's exactly right. It has to be, you know, safe and better than the incumbent materials. So we're very closely involved with the SAE and the automotive OEMs.
Have you seen the future of refrigerants?
I think we may have. I think we know what's coming, right? I mean, it's all about improving global warming potential. So years ago, there was a Montreal Protocol that was around ozone depletion. So the concern was that the chlorine and that was in the refrigerants was depleting the ozone. So you may have heard years ago, there's this hole in the ozone, you know,
and it's right.
Like, oh no, what do we do? And so then that meeting and agreement was ratified and then countries signed up to say, all right, well, we're going to get rid of chlorine in refrigerants. So they moved from chlorine, CFCs, chlorofluorocarbons, to hydrofluorocarbons, HFCs. So these are fully saturated, non-chlorine containing materials, extremely stable molecules that don't hurt the ozone. And over time, that ozone has repaired itself a little bit.
Let's remind our audience, chlorofluorocarbons was R12, am I right?
Correct.
And then the R134 became the hydrofluorocarbons.
See, you're learning so fast. You haven't.
Well, I've been around the horn a little bit, but I just took a flyer on that.
Okay, yeah, no, that's exactly right.
All right. Okay.
I think then the problem that we started to see was that the molecules were too stable. These HFCs, you know, they were stable in the system. They didn't hurt the ozone layer, but they also didn't break up in the atmosphere soon enough. So these molecules, when leaked or released or vented, would sit in the atmosphere for 13 years on average before they would degrade. And so that created this kind of blanket over the atmosphere that would prevent heat from getting out. So solar radiation would come down, and then this blanket would prevent the heat from exiting, warming up the earth. And that's when you start to hear about some of the negative effects, climate change, polar ice cap melting, things of this nature.
Because we weren't recycling or recovering anything.
Right. Whenever that material was in the atmosphere, it sat there for 13 years. So the industry said, all right, well, we need to, and the regulatory body said, we need to address this. And that's the reason for this shift away from 134A to what's called HFOs, which are hydrofluoroolefins. They're still HFCs. They just have a double bond in it. And so the main difference is that double bond is where oxygen in the atmosphere can attack and rip the molecule apart. So while 134 was in the atmosphere 13 years, molecules like 1234YF and other HFOs last only about 13 days. So it's a completely different time scale. These molecules dissipate in the atmosphere and the GWP is lower as a result.
Chemicals are scary.
Well, they're confusing, I think. And yeah, the lack of understanding sometimes breeds some fear, but that's why it's good to learn. I mean, there's information that you hear from different sources, but you know, we believe it's just good to teach and educate where possible to demystify it.
You told me that fluorine is being vilified. But what's it have to do with the EV lithium battery?
That's a separate one. So fluorine is essential, right? In many ways, it's the highest composition component in the lithium battery. It's in propellants. It's in, you know, foams, firefighting agents, you know, in addition to refrigerants and thermal management. So it is an absolutely essential material in everyday life. So to take it to its limit of get rid of fluorine would then prevent the progress in these other segments that we're seeing. To make fluorine the enemy is, we don't believe that's anywhere near what we...
Let's just work with it, respect it, treat it right.
Yeah, exactly. Understand what it's for and how to use it. And in fact, the natural refrigerants that you hear about sometimes, like CO2 and propane and ammonia, these were some of the earliest refrigerants.
Yeah.
But each of those has a fundamental flaw. So CO2, as an example, operates at a very high pressure to get the performance that we need. It's called a transcritical system where it's, you know, above the critical point of the vapor dome. And propane, as we know, it's a hydrocarbon, so flammability is there. It's a concern. So with that, there's a limit to how much charge you can put in and how much refrigeration capacity you could do as a result. And ammonia has a toxicity issue. So the industry said, well, we need to do something here. It was the refrigerant selection went from whatever works to, okay, we need to protect safety and toxicity and flammability. So as you do that, when you look at the periodic table, the scientists said, all right, well, how do we do that? What elements could we use that we're not using? What building blocks do we take? And what they concluded was, as you move up and to the right on the periodic table, things got better from both a flammability and a toxicity standpoint. And the element that's on the top right that isn't one of the inert is fluorine. So fluorine's sitting there and chlorine's right below it. And sure enough, when we looked into making refrigerants there, the toxicity and the flammability improved.
Wow, it has a happy home there, huh?
It does, yeah.
I never knew that.
Yeah,
Top right, huh?
Fluorine's the most electronegative material, so it's very stable with hydrogen. Yeah, it's a great molecule, and it delivers these benefits that the industry was looking
for. So what's the challenges in the future in these EVs? And I know heat pump, we've been talking about that here for 2 days, and that we've got to heat the battery and then cool the battery. There's so many different things. What is Cora involved in helping make this technology work and plan the future?
Many different ways, right? I mean, we make some of our fluorine goes into the lithium ion battery. So we've got a group working there. But on the refrigerant side, you know, we're looking at how to make products that enable heat pumps. And one of the most important ones is efficiency, because heat pumps basically take a unit of energy. They consume a unit of electrical energy at the compressor, and they produce an output of about 3 units of energy. You know, you eat one and you get 3 out. It's great. So how can we make that efficiency as good as possible? Because when you improve that efficiency, it goes directly to range.
So you're talking about a chemical that would do the transfer of the energy?
Right, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, so when it's bidirectional, so when it's warm outside, then it cools where it's warm and warms where it's cool, depending on what the needs are.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the refrigerants are, we've found that with all the different constraints and regulations, that our point of view is that a single component really can't do everything that is needed anymore. So we know that fluorine is essential. We know that what the constraints and regulations are going to say. And then it's a matter of, well, how do we develop a combination of these building blocks, so to speak, to deliver the best performing heat pump system we can get?
If you went to Apex 2023, then you realize the incredible commitment that Apex has to the service professional, shop owner, technician, and service advisor. Joe's Garage is your place to hang out with 10 working bays and real live working conditions. Also, the best tech companies, from tools and repair to management software, had their latest and greatest on display and demonstrated for you. You also attended technical and business management training with the industry's best and brightest trainers, coaches, and teachers. Work is underway to make next year's Apex 2024 have even more product demos, trending training, marketing, and social media support to help you grow your career, sales, and profits. Remember, if you earn your living in the service aftermarket, then Apex is the expo for you. Continue listening, and we'll bring you the latest from Apex 2024. Save the date, November 5th through the 7th, 2024. Let's face it, your shop management system is the single most important tool in your shop, period. NapaTrax was built from the ground up to make your business more profitable and efficient. We provide an extensive set of tools to increase and track profitability in real time. NapaTrax offers the industry's best post-sale support, hands down, and we train your people on site. Yep, on site. And we offer remote refresher training 10 times a week, and customer support is open 6 days a week. Give us a call, visit the website, or join our Facebook community today to learn more. We'll prove to you that Trax is the single best shop management system in the business. NapaTrax is always customized and tailored for you, whether you're a one-man shop or a large multi-bay or multi-location company. After all, it's your shop, so it's your choice. Visit us on the web at NapaTrax, that's NapaTrax.com.
Have we done everything to tap fluorine can do for in the future? I mean, is there still more to learn?
At any point in time, we probably said, well, I don't know what else there could be. I
mean, it's like a cocktail. Put a little vodka in there. Yeah. Try some bourbon.
Yeah. We can't know everything, right? I mean, that's the kind of the fun part of science, is the more you learn, the more you kind of wonder and go, well, I wonder if we could figure out a way to do this and find the boundary of what we know and then try to get a little bit past
the experimenters.
Sure.
There should be a movie like that.
Yeah. Well,
Let them loose in the lab.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Sure. Yeah. But it's exciting because there are real problems to solve and there are constraints. So it's really a puzzle. So how do you navigate in between the guardrails to deliver the best outcome? And I think that's where having a bunch of different points of view, a bunch of different options for that is really the fun part.
So the people on the floor at the show here, what are they talking to you about?
Well, really, it's just understanding what the heck these regulations are doing.
Sure.
Because they're changing so much. And so what they want to know is the response to the signal. So when a regulation changes, what does that mean? Not just for the industry, but for me as a shop owner, for me as an aftermarket technician. They're just asking, really, when will these alternatives be available? What do I need to know about handling them? How different are they than what I'm used to? And yeah.
Do you have answers for
them? Mostly. Yeah. I mean, we've launched a couple. You know, Cora's launched 456A and 444A recently. So 456A is a direct replacement for 134A. So that's the one where, you know, if that availability becomes constrained because of the regulations, then you can just drop 456 in there right away. And 444A is a direct replacement for 1234YF systems. So it's an A2L, but the system architecture can stay the same. And there's actually a performance benefit with 444A. So we're trying to...
Do you work with some of the recyclers, the machines that are, you know, hooked to the car? I mean, can all of the stuff that's coming out new work in these current recycling systems that we have?
The systems, yes, but there's going to be have to be guardrails and definitions around how we do that. So what we recommend is to have dedicated machines for each refrigerant to make sure that you keep things straight. Best practice is to pull everything out of the system and put in fresh, you know, per service.
Man, can you imagine the equipment that you'll need in the future to handle 25 years worth of thermal management?
Well, and as more options come about, more equipment will be needed. And so that's why it's critical to partner as an industry. I mean, it can't just be us developing refrigerants and then telling someone about it. It's got to be, okay, here are the things that we're thinking about. What problems does that create for the machine manufacturers and for the identifier manufacturers? And how can we help make your life easier while we develop these solutions? And then the industry kind of selects based on what the options are available.
Anything to do with safety, you know, just being careful handling this product, or is it all just so sealed and not exposed that you don't really have to worry about that?
Yeah, I mean, safety is always a concern, but the way that, you know, we've addressed it historically is to partner with the EPA for SNAP approvals. So there's the significant new alternatives policy program where you can apply to have a refrigerant listed for a given application. So for mobile, as an example, you know, you apply and say, here's a refrigerant, we want you to consider it to recommend for use in its application. And as part of that process, there's a detailed risk assessment that's done and an evaluation by the EPA to say, yeah, we're comfortable listing this as a safe alternative. It's predicated on the OEMs and the manufacturers and the other component suppliers to make sure the due diligence is done so that it's safe for consumers to use. But as far as the risk assessment in terms of leaks, in terms of the handling, toxicity, if it's SNAP listed, that risk assessment has been done. And so consumers can feel comfortable that this is a safe, good product to use.
Are you in sales or training for Cura?
I'm in business development. So I was an engineer by degree.
See, because I was wondering how you got so smart. So you're an engineer.
Yeah, the engineering training is what does a lot of it. Yeah, I mean, I think understanding how the systems work, understanding the constraints and things are the first part, but then explaining these in a way that's...
And you've done that well here.
We're trying. I mean, there's a lot to unpack, and there's sincere questions that people want to know. And so we try as best we can to be transparent with them. I mean, we say what we know, we say what we don't, but what we're working on. And, you know, our approach has been just to be a partner. I mean, we try and be open, transparent, and, you know, collaborative with everyone, right? There are competitors that are working on similar products.
You know, what I find fascinating is you riddled off 444A, 456A. Mm-hmm. Is that a universal number that SAE would assign to it, and then everyone goes and works on the same formula, all the competitors?
No. So the formulas are assigned by ASHRAE. So there was a meeting end of January, so it was just a few days ago, where, you know, the different applications come in, there's a formula presented, and if ASHRAE agrees, they assign a number to it. And that number is tied to that molecule. So then sometimes you see letters after the blend names, right?
Yes.
So you see 444A, 456A. In the future, you could see 444B or C. So what that means is the number is tied to a set of constituents. So 444A, as an example, has 1234ZE, it has R32, and it has R152A as part of the blend. If you change the composition of those three materials, the letter changes at the end. So it'd be 444B. So those letters denote a composition of those three constituents.
Okay, big question. Why F? The end of 1, 2, 3, 4, YF. There were that many iterations of that formula?
No, so almost every digit is significant. So 1234YF is a single component molecule, just like 134A is. And you might notice that the YF are lowercase and the A in 134 is lowercase.
Yeah.
Those digits in that letter denote a structure. That's a molecular structure. So that name, 1234YF, describes, I mean, to someone, you know, smarter than me, they could sit there and really write the structure if they could see that number. So is it, you know, the position of the atoms on the different molecules and how many fluorines there are and the positions of everything, that's what the number is at the single component level. So the blends, like 444A, combines those single numbers together as a blend.
And you think you have a very simple job in this very simple industry of ours.
I don't know if it's simple. It's important.
And no, I'm talking to my listener. My listener says, oh, my God, this is a piece of cake. Are you kidding me? Just put the jug on there, press this button, and go. And not necessarily thinking, my brain's fried. It's been a Swiss cheese week here listening. I'm thrilled we could bring this information to the industry.
Yeah, great.
But it stops me to respect all that it takes to do everything that we sometimes take for granted, Adam.
Well, yeah, and I think the important thing to note is it isn't just our industry that's working this hard and developing these kind of solutions.
Absolutely.
There's all these other, the lubricant manufacturers, the identifier manufacturers. I mean, there's so much that go behind it, but the certifications are kind of to say you can trust this result because it's been verified by, you know, in our case, either the EPA or, you know, ASHRAE or whoever would list it, that we've done our due diligence so you can feel confident using this in your applications moving forward.
So as a competitor, they're all making the same stuff. You wouldn't say that I have any more value add than they do?
Well, there's different points of view. I mean, some competitors make exactly the same materials as others. 134A, as an example, is a commodity now. You can get that
right
anywhere. For the new ones, there is IP kind of around the new formulations and things. So that's something to navigate. But, you know, the competitor's point of view sometimes can be, one molecule does everything. We don't need blends. Blends are confusing. They're hard to handle. We don't understand what to do if it leaks. And our point of view is the blend doesn't limit you anymore to the properties of a single component. It opens up only options.
Don't ask me why, but I'm already confused when you say single component.
Yeah.
I don't get that part.
Okay.
Don't you take the chemicals, you blend them together, and you get this 456A? Or are you telling me that 456A is a single component?
Yeah, it's a mixture of three single components.
Ah.
So it is a blend. So if you see that 400 number with a capital letter, that's a blend. And it could be a 400 series or a 500 series with that capital letter. But if it's a, you know, 1234 or 134 with a small letter, that's a single component.
Wow.
I mean, there's no easy way to explain that. That's just...
Guess what now? Yeah. We all have an idea that that's not a branding thing. That's a chemical thing.
That's right. And the names do seem... Why would you come up with this letter combination and number combination?
Yeah. And what's the next one going to be? It'll never be letters. It'll never be XYZ anything, will it?
Not in the front. No. No, it has to be. The numbers denote the structure. But I think once you realize that, okay, well, there is this reason behind the nomenclature, you know, it gets a little bit easier to, and you can Google, right? I mean, what does that structure look like? You know, how do you tie the characters in the name to a structural property?
Cool. So, please go Google this.
Oh, yeah.
That's please fun. Go Google this. The R, what's the R in front of me?
Refrigerant.
Pew. Hello.
That's the easy one.
one answer.
Yep.
A one word answer.
One word answer. That's the application.
What else should we know you want to tell us?
There's different points of view out there on just blends. And I mentioned some of them, but there's this principle about refrigerant glide. He's also, if there's a leak.
Refrigerant glide.
Yeah. So what that means is, so for a refrigerant that starts with a 400 something, the different blend components boil at different temperatures. So the one that boils the coldest comes off first and so on and so forth. And there's concern over, well, how do you know what the composition is if it leaks? Because isn't the one that's going to boil at a colder temperature going to leak first? And, you know, the answer is, well, in theory, sure. But I think in practice, what we've seen through testing is that before performance and even the composition appreciably changes, you need to have a bulk leak of around 25% or some amount that you would really notice in performance. Okay, the air isn't cold anymore. What's going on here? Well, there's a significant system leak at that point. So the concern over what's the composition of a blend like this really is more technical than practical. So that's a big one that we like to talk about. And that glide is a temperature difference between the boiling point of the highest boiling one and the lowest boiling one. So that's the range of boiling points.
It's a glide.
It's a glide, yep. So as the boiling happens, that boiling point changes from one temperature to the other. The concern over that would be, well, how do you control the system and you know, to make sure that your set points and things are right for your superheats and subcools? And like anything, it's an opportunity. It isn't trivial, but it also isn't prohibitive. Having a glide encourages the use of more blends. It gives you more options to use. And in the case of automotive, glide can actually help because the pressure drop of those automotive heat exchangers that tend to be kind of small work the fluid really hard. So glide can actually counteract that pressure drop to protect your performance a little bit. So it can be a good thing.
A wider gap, you mean?
A gap between the high side and the low side. Right. Yeah. So that's your cooling capacity.
A bigger glide.
Yeah. So you don't want the glide to be huge.
I get it. But there's some benefit.
Yeah. So, I mean, in an ideal system, you would look at the pressure drop of the evaporator and go, well, if the glide can give us that same, the temperature difference that's associated with that pressure drop, our performance is, you know, ideal.
And the customer comes in and says, I just want my car to be cold.
Right. And so then it's our job to develop the refrigerant that'll do that for them.
And to have the brainiacs out in the bays.
Exactly.
To fix it right. To me, to understand actually everything that they touch has so much science behind it, so much manufacturing behind it, so much fluorine behind it.
Yeah, yeah. So, it's the result of years and decades of R&D and improvement and regulatory progress, I'll say. Sure, I mean, we've learned that GWP is a problem. Now we're working to solve it, just as we did with ODP, you know, years ago. So as we learn more, we adapt, we solve the problems, we develop new solutions, and you know, the performance of the vehicles improves as a result of that. If efficiencies go up, mileage goes up, right? Your EV battery range goes up. So efficiency is becoming a critical part of all of this. And that's another point that maybe I wanted to say was that, well, natural refrigerants like CO2 have a GWP of 1. So 444A, as an example, has a GWP of 93. It's almost 100 times more. So a logical question could be, why would I move to a GWP that's higher than something else? And the answer to that is that efficiency point. So at some point below 150 GWP, efficiency starts to overtake GWP in terms of the life cycle carbon footprint. So if our goal truly is minimizing atmospheric carbon, we have to consider efficiency as well as the scope 1 and 2 emissions in terms of what that actual footprint looks like. GWP, a critical component of that. It can't be 1400. It can't be thousands. But once you get down to that small sub 150, the efficiency starts to have a more pronounced effect and even overtake GWP as the driver.
Okay.
So hopefully that was clear.
I understood everything. Yes. Talk radio for the auto service professional. You got it right here, man. Adam Kimmel, Cora, thank you for hurting my brain, but helping our audience get a brand new appreciation for what it takes to make refrigerants.
Well, I hope it was informative. And of course, we're always open for questions for, you know, can you explain slowly what you said on the podcast or something?
Always open. Come back and do a show on GWP, please.
Sure. We could do an acronym episode, right? Pick an acronym.
Oh my
and we'll
God. Oh, don't go there. Just don't go there. That
is a 2-hour marathon.
What I try to do is to explain as best as I can. What is GWP again?
Global warming potential.
See, there you go. My audience would have been pissed if I didn't ask you that.
And ODP was ozone depleting potential. So right, it's how likely. So the lower, the better for both of those.
Yeah, I got ODP written down, but I didn't get GDP, right?
Yep. GWP.
GWP, global warming.
Yeah, potential.
Potential. And ours refrigerant. Yes. Thank you very much. That's a hard acronym to learn right there. Hey, man, thanks for being on.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thanks. Yeah, this was fun.
It was great.
Yep.
Thanks for being on board to listen and learn from the premier automotive aftermarket podcast. Until next time.